Hi, and welcome to Wish Upon a Star. Wish Upon a Star is an exciting program that showcases up-and-coming stars in the musical, visual, performing, creative, and literary arts arenas. We will discuss with professional guests about songwriting, entertainment law, literary careers, copywriting, publishing, promoters, and other topics of importance in these highly competitive industries. It gives us great pleasure today to introduce another series in our Starlight series. It is about global, multicultural, and multilingual conversational issues. It gives the station Wish Upon a Star a great deal of pleasure to introduce our special guest this week, Dr. Edith Moss Jackson. Her biography. Dr. Edith Moss Jackson is a professor, author, researcher, writer, and an expert in Spanish language literature. Her credentials are extremely impressive to confirm this achievement. She has a BA degree in Spanish literature from the University of Pennsylvania, a master's in Spanish literature from Harvard University, and earned her PhD in Spanish literature from the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Moss Jackson has taught at State University at Albany as professor of Spanish, lecturer at Morgan State University, lecturer at Howard University, Department of Modern Languages and Cultures in Washington, D.C. She has traveled extensively to several Spanish-speaking countries. She has given several conference presentations on Hispanic cultures at professional national meetings in Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, Salvador de Bahia, Canada, Cuba, Havana, and several other countries. Dr. Jackson is also the author of The Forgotten Text. This is a text, a collection of poetry and documentation of the intensity and vitality of the creative spirit of a people's love, death, and religious faith, disenchantment, alienation, and messages that Afro-Argentines chose to express, giving a voice to a marginalized people. Again, we say, welcome to the show, Dr. Jackson.
Thank you. Happy to be here. And just call me Edith.
Oh, all right. Thank you. Well, we're going to start off with, I guess, like they say, right from the beginning. We do not expect everyone we meet to know how to speak English, Edith. Why has a knowledge of Spanish become even more important to have as Americans today?
A knowledge of Spanish is vital today because of the great influx that we have of Spanish speakers that's increasing. As a matter of fact, children are just walking across the borders with the best wishes and love of their parents who want them to have a better life. And so we also have the dreamers who've been here, sons and daughters of immigrants, who became a part of American culture and who hold down jobs but cannot qualify for citizenship, although they now have some legislation that's in process for the Dreamers, with the issue being the path to citizenship. We have political events that have taken place recently, such as the accord between Cuba and the United States, through the foresight of President Obama, with the encouragement of Pope Francis of the Catholic Church. All have agreed that the suffering that the Cuban people have experienced because of the blockade of the importation of products, with only the United States opposing their presence, the presence of the Cubans at certain world meetings, that it made sense to review that policy. And I can't really quote Obama, but I would say that the president explained that after 50 years, if the policy hasn't brought about what it sought to accomplish, that it's time to do something different. So for political reasons, for cultural reasons, for economic reasons, it's important to become more aware and even to learn the Spanish language.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure a lot of people can attest to that just in our own neighborhoods. When choosing a course of study and career, why did you decide to study Spanish?
Well, actually, that's a two-part question. Originally, I became interested actually in middle school way back long ago, longer than I want to admit. I had an extremely fluent and extremely good teacher of Spanish, and she did not allow us to speak English in class at all. She kept conversation going, and I would feel after I'd been in there for 45 minutes, when I left, I'd feel a tingling in my head. I found that very exciting that I was able to understand people when I would hear them in conversation. I began to experiment with reading on my own, and I discovered some information about the Moors, people from northern Africa who had conquered Spain and had been there for 800 years, a topic that's of interest to people interested in Spanish culture, but the historians in those days didn't like to talk about the African presence in Spain. A lot of that's changing today. Then I guess when I was in high school, there was a real estate broker who asked me one day, didn't my family say that I studied Spanish? And I said, yes. He said, well, we need you to do this right away. I said, what? He said, we want you to translate these instructions for hair pomade because we have to put it on the label, and if we don't do it now, then we'll lose this opportunity. And I said, well, I'm not sure I'm good enough for that. They said, you'll be fine, just do it. So I did it, and they paid me for it. Of course, I had to sign a paper to release them of any future pay and a lot of things that, you know, my mother found very interesting because she had to approve all of this. I then also began to look at some films about Latin America in general, and I remember when Black Orpheus, which has to do with Brazil, it's a Portuguese-speaking country, but it was under the rubric of Latin America, and it was such a beautiful film. It had a lot of carnival scenes. I got a chance to see samba dancing, and I found the Spanish to be very exciting. I liked the flamenco music, and eventually, when I was in college, though, I decided that I was going to major as a pre-med student. And I had taken all of the biology and botany classes that I could, but I transferred to a different university. And there they told me I could not take any more science classes without 2 years of calculus and one of physics. Well, I found the physics to be something that I felt I could do, but in those days, math fear among women was rather great, and I just didn't think I could do 2 years of calculus. Today, if I had been my own advisor, if I were able to advise another student, I would say it's always better to attempt something than to walk away from it.
Right.
Because that's what you learn about yourself, you learn about your capabilities. But at that time, I didn't have a mentor. And so I said, well, let's see, what else do I like? Well, I said, oh, well, I enjoy Spanish. So I decided to switch over into Spanish.
Oh, excellent. And in that early learning stages, did anybody else in your family, any of your relatives speak Spanish?
Yes. actually in New York City in Brooklyn. I had a first cousin who owned a beauty shop, and her husband was there. He was a Spanish speaker, but he didn't speak very much. I don't know whether he didn't know a lot of English or whether he was just the silent type. But I didn't hear him speaking too much. But she talked a lot about his culture. And so that also motivated me. And, of course, as an adult, after I finished the university, my second cousin married the daughter of a scholar from Panama. So we had the Puerto Rican interaction, Puerto Rican and the Panamanian interaction.
Oh, great. So you had an opportunity to continue speaking in, even in close familiarity with your family. That's great. Sometimes
yes.
we lose it if we don't use it. Years
True.
Ago, one had to learn a foreign language before they could graduate. What do you think about nowadays, if it becomes a prerequisite that you learn at least Spanish in school before you graduate? How do you think that would go over?
I think that it's crucial. I think that of all the languages, Spanish would be the one to take because of these changes that are taking place in our society. I know that Chinese is also another vital language. Previously, they were encouraging Japanese. But I think these language preferences follow the political dynamics. And at this time, I think Spanish would be the preferred language of all.
Absolutely. So you think it might work. Like you said, it should be. Most European languages have a somewhat romantic tone to them. Can we agree that the Spanish language can be considered more or less a romantic language?
Yes. Spanish is a romantic language because of its musicality.
Okay.
The musicality comes from the abundance of vowels that you find in use in Spanish language. But Spanish is also a romance language. That is to say, its mother or the parent tongue is Latin. And as the Roman Empire spread, soldiers went throughout various places, including Asia, Africa, Europe, other parts of Europe, that is to say. And soldiers are not known to speak standard language all the time. So as they changed their speech patterns, especially in combination with the regions in which they were located, we get differing languages that develop from the mother tongue.
Mm-hmm.
So the languages of the Romance family are Italian, which directly developed from Rome. That was very easy. French, Spanish, Portuguese, and Romanian.
Oh, okay.
These languages,
yeah. We can set that right in there with the rest of them.
I find it easy, even if you have not studied, I haven't studied Italian, but
right.
I find that it's possible to recognize some similarities between the languages, sort of just as brothers and sisters have some identifying commonalities. This is so also with the languages, that you can find some common features.
Exactly. Edith, I know you have traveled extensively, especially to Spanish-speaking countries. What were some of your experiences? And like you said, part two of the question was there any difficulty in communicating with the native countrymen? And you can take as much time as you want to answer any question.
Well, my very first trip came after I had earned my bachelor's degree in Spanish. we had read very advanced materials, so I knew how to talk about philosophy in Spanish, and I said, well, now is my chance to go and see these places that I've read about. When I got to Spain, however, I found that the everyday things were not easily understood when I heard them spoken. Or I would walk into a restaurant and I found it difficult to order a meal because, you know, I was pretty much accustomed to reading cultural information, not just the everyday. So that was one difference that I found. In Spain, however, at that time, I don't know how it is today, but I found that I had made certain arrangements to stay on the university campus. I went over on a student boat, and I had made these arrangements in advance. But when I got there, the room was not available. And I found that it was rather shocking for me as a young woman alone in another country, because I was heading on to meet up with another group of people. But at that time in Madrid, I didn't have a place to stay. So I was sitting in the train station. I was crying. And a soldier came over with his mother and another relative, and they wanted to know what the problem was. We were speaking all in Spanish, and I understood that clearly. But that wasn't like reading a menu. But the everyday things were like reading a novel or something where they have everyday events. You don't usually read a menu in a novel, but you may read about a train station situation. So they said they would help me, and they eventually found a place for me for young señoritas. It's for students who study abroad. By abroad, I mean, if they're from southern Spain, they come to Madrid. It's a place where women who want a respectable life can rent a space. They put me in a room. When I was in that room, there were no blinds at the window or curtains. And I would have to sort of get dressed in a dark corner at night, not have the light on, in order to have some privacy. So after I was there for a night, the next day, somewhere in the evening, they asked me to join them for dinner. And so the young women and the dueña, the woman who was in charge, began to invite us to then, after dinner, to leave, and we'd walk around and choose through the plaza. And, you know, we'd have this after-dinner kind of packed practice every day. I then found that I was able to get what's called a pension. And I also shared an apartment eventually with three other young women while I was in Madrid. I found it to be exciting. I then traveled on to Burgos, which is north of Madrid. And there I saw the actual Roman aqueducts. That is to say, the engineering of the Romans was still present. And the Cid, who was the first and most important warrior of Spain, and his wife were buried in the cathedral there. So then the other trips that I have made are using Spanish in Hispanic countries were in Latin America and the Caribbean. So let's see. I don't know the kind of what interests you most about the different countries. How I'm received?
How you communicate? Because that's the thrust of our discussion here. That eventually we're going to have to know how to communicate with all the multilingual people in our communities. So as you were speaking earlier, you said you went to Madrid and you could not order anything from the restaurant or menu because it wasn't just like a conversational type thing. Do they as well have different dialects? Some countries have several dialects, and just because you can speak one dialect, you may not be able to converse in several other ones. Did you find that prevalent?
Well, no, actually, I can say that there was some difference in terms of dialects. For example, when I went to Argentina, where I actually lived for 2 years, when I first arrived in Argentina, they were not using the familiar, well, let me just explain this about Spanish. Spanish has a formal way of addressing when we speak in a court or in some other kind of situation. We use the term for you, which is usted. And if it's plural, let's say there's two judges sitting there, you would say ustedes. In Argentina, they do not, and then we have the also the familiar, the two, for a person that is your age or let's say you are good friends or your brothers and sisters, you address them in a familiar way with tú for you. Or the plural of that would be vosotros. In Argentina, they do not use the tú form. They use something that's called the voseo or the vos form. So there was a difference in actual vocabulary as fundamental as the pronouns themselves. When I was in Argentina, or the sound of me llamo, my name is, or I call myself, they would say me llamo. There was a harder form. I found that
right.
I had to listen really carefully to understand because it seemed to differ from the way things were written, the way I learned them. In other countries, in Colombia, it was the closest to the Spanish of Spain in terms of pronunciation. I find the challenge for understanding to be great with the Caribbean speakers. For example, in Puerto Rico, or I guess you may have overheard Puerto Ricans on subway in New York, and even the signs on subways are bilingual or sometimes just in Spanish themselves. But in Puerto Rico, they do not pronounce the final R of the infinitive. For example, to speak is hablar, but they would just say habla. You wouldn't hear the R at all. So they also speak with a greater velocity. They speak with greater speed in Spanish in Puerto Rico. So those were differences. However, in Peru, in Lima, there was no difference. It was just as the Colombians and the Spaniards. I mean, it was we would call it a purer type of speaking. So it was less like a dialect and more like the standard, which is the official way of speaking languages, is the standard, the one that sets the norm. So the greater diversity that I found was in Puerto Rican speaking. Let's see, I'm trying to think of another place. In terms of communicating, I had learned to, since I lived in Argentina for 2 years, hearing these regional differences were not disturbing to me. It was initially, but not once I had been immersed in the language for so long. The regional differences didn't and still do not bother me. But when you're a beginning learner, it sometimes is a challenge.
Right.
When you're learning a language, you're not going to be learning all the diverse dialects and regionalisms at one time. So
right.
It really doesn't matter for the beginning speaker. You just need to learn where you are, how they speak. And once you get that fundamental basis, then you're able to handle any situation that you find.
Oh, wow, that's really great. What we're going to do right now, Edith, is take a break, and we'll be right back. Hi, and welcome back to Wish Upon a Star. This is Andel, your host. I want to say again, thank you for listening. And you can always listen to the archives once the show is gone off the air. We are broadcasting on www.bbsradio.com, Station 2. Again, we're going to return to our very special guest today, Dr. Edith Moss Jackson. Edith, just in your dissertation about all of your extensive Spanish traveling, you also mentioned that it was some standards in speaking Spanish, and I think I can identify with that. I taught in Virginia, and I had a class full of maybe 5 or 6 different nationalities. And at that time, I was trying to learn Spanish, and I said a word in class, and one of the Spanish speaking students said, well, Miss Banks, you just called her a name. I said, oh, and I haven't spoke Spanish since. Because as you said, one word, if not pronounced correctly, could mean something else. What were your basic insights or lessons you learned as a result of the travels abroad as to their culture and how someone could actually, what would be the best way to really communicate with them? Based on their culture as well.
You mean if you are in a different country?
Yes.
How to communicate with those people there?
Yes.
Or do you, I'm not, can you repeat the, can you repeat just the last part of the question, please?
Yes, like I would say even here, what would be the best way you approach a person if you're trying to communicate with them? You don't necessarily speak the language, but we still can communicate. What type of approach would you suggest?
Well, I feel that it's understood that language is a system of symbols and signs. And so what you do is you try to tap into what the other person understands, find a common basis for communication. And some have mentioned how body language is a way to communicate. Language is linked to thought. In other words, any word that we have is both a combination of sound and ideas. So if we learn to gesture, if we learn to like act out what it is that we are trying to say, even if we don't know the verbal word, we can communicate the idea with our actions and our movements. I think
right.
That when you talk to people from another culture, it's important to also let them understand your interest in their culture and your respect for differences and similarities.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I was saying that because, of course, we can't just wake up one day and say we're going to begin to speak an understandable foreign language. Let's take Spanish. But what are some noticeable differences between the English and Spanish language?
Well, I think one of the differences between English and Spanish would be the use of gender. That is to say, we do not, because we don't base our language on Latin, where they have what's called gender, their masculine and feminine words. That doesn't mean that they link up with sexual differences. It just means that in the language, in its grammar, they are, if they end with an A, they're usually feminine. They end with an O, this is in Spanish. If they end with an O, then it's masculine. In Latin, the words that end with O came from U-S ending words that were masculine. So the whole idea of having gender, I think, is different. I think that another difference between English and Spanish would be that there are silent sounds, some things that are not spoken, even though they're written.
Oh,
that's mm-hmm. true between French and Spanish, for example. But I think I'd much rather focus on the commonalities between English and Spanish.
Right.
We have tenses. We're able to talk about the present, the past, the future in English as well as in Spanish. In English, however, we also have conjugation. That is to say, we want to express who is doing the action. I speak, you speak, he speaks, or
right.
he or it speaks. We speak, you speak, plural, or they speak. We have those things in common. In English, you have to use the pronoun. You have to say,
right.
I speak. However, in Spanish, the word ending are very important. They let you know who the speaker is, whether you state that subject or not. Also, stress is important. We have accented words in Spanish that do not exist in English. What is common about it is that we are able to express what time that action is taking place. For example, hablo español means I speak Spanish. Hablo español means either he spoke Spanish or she spoke Spanish or they spoke Spanish. So whether there's a written accent or not can change the tense. Let's see if I can think of another. Similarities. We have the same word order. I speak Spanish. Subject, verb, object. We have that same word order in Spanish. Hablo, or yo hablo español. I speak Spanish. Same thing. Just that the words are different, but it's the same structure. So structurally, they're very common, English and Spanish.
Oh, I see. When I was trying to get some background on this subject matter as well, and I stopped and I said, I'll let you handle that, it had spoke about that particular issue about grammar, that in speaking the different multilinguals, because English is so ingrained in grammar, that leads to my next question. What would be a starting point in teaching Spanish to a novice?
Well, the starting point for speaking, for teaching the Spanish, is to point out, to whatever degree you can, whatever similarities they are, that then people feel a little less intimidated.
Okay.
The best way of teaching, for example, is to show in English that and that have the same sound except for the beginning sound of the B or the M, to let people understand that language is meaningful sounds. The arrangement of them grammatically also affects meaning, to try to get people to communicate within the language itself. Once you point out in the very first contact with the student, you want to show the overview of how language is a system and what its component parts are. But after that time, the way Spanish is taught today, people stay within the Spanish language itself and to whatever degree they can do not refer to English at all, except for explaining grammatical differences. In other words, the way it's taught now, the classroom becomes sort of a type of workshop. The preparation takes place out of the class. You give a very small, maybe 10-minute overview of what's going to take place on that day in that class. And because you've already assigned some of that information, it's the application that's important, a like we don't talk about the language, or we don't just act it out. We actually use those words in meaningful communication. So you don't learn just isolated vocabulary and then down the road begin to use it in speech. You actually will get a little dialogue that's small, maybe 8 lines, and that dialogue will be representative of how to communicate, not only in that given situation, let's say it's in a train station, you would learn the vocabulary that's related to how you greet a friend and you're going to go to the, wherever you're going to go. Let's say go to the theater because you've met and one person isn't from there, so they have to describe what their city is like. That would be the vocabulary that you would get. And then in your class, you would actually have them to create their own dialogue.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's a new way of doing it, I guess.
Vocabulary in meaningful communication with each other.
Right.
Lots of times in classes, people are given computerized, some of the books come with computerized exercises, so that if they find that something isn't really coming across in their memory, if they're processing what's been assigned, they can go and get additional practice on the computer in whatever that issue is. And how do they know what the issue is they need to focus on? The fact that it is computerized, and, you know, the assignment will give you like a little test at the end. Maybe it's only just 5 sentences or something like that. But if you find that your answers are not matching up with the correct answers, then you know what to go back and to study, which makes it less intimidating of someone who walks in and says, well, I looked at it last night, but I didn't, you know, didn't understand it.
Right.
Then when they come to class, the classroom is not only for additional practice on something new that you give them to do that's related, it's also the time for problem solving, because they will point out what it was that they didn't understand while they were by themselves, so that you can then review that. So the class usually consists of a review segment of whatever was done previously in a summarized brief way, then presentation of new information, and then the application of that to something else that lets you know how they're performing, whether they understand it or not.
Right. Check and balance it out to see if you're understanding. What do you think, if you have any comment, about software language learning?
I haven't learned a language myself independently through software, but I've heard very good things about Rosetta Stone, because it tends to work with images that, I mean, this is what I read about it, the images that you must therefore use in your communication. Like, it's not a lot of talking about the language, it's direct application, because you have to react to the image. This is what I've read about it. I don't know really very much about some of the independent software. I do know of the ones that are text-related, in which everything coordinates what you're reading in class along with these exercises that they give you that are computerized.
Right. Okay, that's very interesting. We're going to take another little break, and we'll be right back. Hi, and welcome back to Wish Upon a Star. This is Andell Banks, your host, and we're broadcasting from www.bbsradio.com, station 2. You can also send us comments and suggestions to email musicradio34@gmail.com. Again, please send us any comments and suggestions to musicradio34@gmail.com. We're going to return to the questioning for our honored guest, Edith Moss Jackson. Edith, as we recognize Black History Month, some of us may not know the contributions of Arturo Schomburg. Why is he important to know at this time?
Arturo Schomburg was very active in the 1920s. He was an Afro-Puerto Rican who was hired by the New York City public library system, and he saved some 10,000 documents over the years of his work there in New York. He also created an Afro-Hispanic Institute and brought into our awareness the contributions of some Afro-Hispanics in Spain that people were not aware of previously. He has been honored, I think it was in the year 2003, with an exhibit at what's called now the Schomburg Center of Research and Culture in New York City in Harlem. That was based on, that center was based on his contribution of these documents that he turned over to the library system, and they set them up in that center. And it has become the core of what their holdings are. Of course, they've built tremendously since his day. But he was also very active with the founder of Black History or African American History Day. The publication of the American Association of the Study of History and Life, the author of Miseducation of the Negro, a person who collaborated with Schomburg, the two of them worked together on some projects with the idea that it's important to excavate the history of African Americans, because this information isn't necessarily always a part of the national histories and textbooks. So this leads to a sense of miseducation, a lack of awareness of the value that African Americans have as contributors of culture. I know in my early days, all that we ever saw in history books had to do with the fact that there had been slavery. And the pictures that you were seeing in those days were those of people who were poorly dressed or poor or laboring and not self-fashioning and aware of themselves. But, of course, all of that changed throughout the 1960s till today. There's been a lot of recovery of information, researching to excavate the past in order to prepare for the future.
I want to again thank you for that information, and I want people to hear that name again, say the name again, so they can possibly go back, like you said, and get some more part of their history they probably have never been introduced to. What was his name again?
Arturo. A-R-T-U-R-O, Schomburg, S as in Sam, C-H-O-M as in Mary, D as in baby, U-R-G. Arturo Schomburg was a mixture of African and German. That's a German surname. But he was born in Puerto Rico, and the reason why he started this kind of research was that he was told in his class, based on what I've read about his life, he was told that Black people never achieved anything. And so he set out as an individual project to uncover the contributions that Black people had made over time. And then he left Puerto Rico and settled in New York. And from there, he was involved with the new Negro movement of the 1920s in the United States. But it was not until the 2003 or around the time that they had that exhibit did people realize that he, with a last name like Schomburg, was an Afro-Puerto Rican.
Right.
Schomburg sounds like a German name, you know, so people just didn't realize what he was. By people, I mean of the current time.
Right.
But the new Negro people knew, they would cite that he was a librarian, but they didn't always mention that he was an Afro-Puerto Rican. He was also a Mason, a part of the Black Masonic League, and had made several trips between Spain and the United States to publicize whatever he could discover about the Spanish-speaking African descended people.
Thank you. Another question, Edith. President Obama supports two programs that promise to create jobs for U.S. citizens who can speak Spanish. Can you give us an outline of these programs, and do you feel they will be of benefit, matter of fact, towards this effort?
The information that I have about the program can be found on the Reach Up website. That actually it's a project of Michelle Obama. She is the one who felt that it's very important to complete education. She was talking about the percentages of students who are not completing the first degree, like the high school diploma. And I think you can get that at reachup.gov. I don't have greater details than that about the program. It's mostly to show what the objectives are. And I attended recently a conference in Washington, D.C., in which they were talking about the figures for the what we call the learning gap between Hispanic, African-American, and other groups. And there was a model program at University of California at San Diego. I don't have the name of that program, but if you were to go to the website of University of California at San Diego and type in Hispanic programs, you would be able to get that kind of information. And I want to make clear that they were really talking about the potential. They weren't really talking about the promise of work for people who knew the Spanish. This is why I want you to see these websites for yourself, because I do not want to misrepresent what is actually happening. What they have had are the research program in San Diego, in which they're talking about how their efforts to support the Hispanics in the college setting have produced increased scores among the students who have participated in programs, and they're talking about how important it was to give them recognition of heritage, recognition of the value of their culture, that this makes a difference in achievement. And then I also saw on the Empowerment Temple website, actually it was on a program. Empowerment Temple is here in Baltimore, Maryland. And there was a discussion of the learning gap among African Americans. And I'm trying to think of the minister's name at this moment. It's not coming to me. But empowermenttemple.com. And that program, they were talking about some 12 or 16% of African Americans who drop out of high school and do not complete the degree, which coincides with the percentage of prisons that are on the agenda for being built. And it was kind of like a horizontal line between the dropouts and the prison system. This was, in a moment, I'll think of the minister's name who was explaining this. So the learning gap creates an earnings gap. The learnings gap creates potential for lack of opportunity, and it has to be corrected. And one aspect of correcting those shortages is cultural information that lets people know about their value. Because if you're living in a society where even the President of the United States is referred to, as the congressman did recently, as a half-breed, or where all the projects that can benefit thousands and millions of people, such as the health programs that have just been promulgated through Obama, if you allow the misinformation to exist and people are not aware of what their potentials are, then they don't have very promising individual lives, and it also leads towards higher crime rates and other issues. I know this is a little far afield of just talking about language, but I think that we should see how this picture is across all of the differing groups.
I'm under the impression, thank you, Edith, that everything is relevant. Even though all of this is in front of us, what is significant about the year 2015 for African descendants in America and the world, for that matter?
Well, there is a global movement that is taking place, and it started back in 2001, actually, with a meeting of representatives from differing African American or African descended organizations throughout the world. So there were people from the United States, from Latin America, from France, from Britain, from other places, and they decided that racism is a problem that has to be solved globally. As a result of that, they continued to have meetings, and they began research projects, so that books have been coming out that people who used to be for with what's called racial democracy, there was the belief that there were no, for example, in Latin America, that we lived in a multicultural world and there were not problems because people mixed and therefore avoided issues. They began to discover when they looked at the data that actually there were some problems in terms of who had accumulated wealth and who had not. And they also discovered that there were some problems of discrimination. Despite the national images of being democracies, that there were problems. So consequently, they set an agenda that by the year 2020, that there would no longer be racism in the world. And they did this in conjunction with the United Nations. So the United Nations made 2011 the year of the Afro-descendant, and then the year of 2015 began the decade of the Afro-descendant. So from 2015 through 2024, the objective is to bring forth information about the cultural accomplishments and contributions, economic, political, any other positive images and information about African descended people, in order to try to thwart injustices that unfortunately still exist around the world,
well,
according to the United Nations.
Right. That all sounds very, very nice, very nice. But as the influx of immigrants continue to move into some neighborhoods, Edith, are we prepared as Americans to accept this divided two-ness of their children being hyphenated, labeled Spanish American for the rest of their lives as we, as African Americans, are called African American instead of just American? Are we prepared for that?
Well, I don't think that we are prepared for it. I think that we should become prepared for all of us to become Americans. But unfortunately, the fact that we still have the term African-American may imply that so far there are no people other than some Europeans. Well, we have some people who are German-Americans, Italian-Americans. We have ethnic festivals where the African-Americans, the Italian-Americans, other groups celebrate their cultures. The problem is that some groups among them are stigmatized. That's to say,
yes,
we don't find German-Americans stigmatized as we may find African-Americans or Afro-Hispanics or Hispanics themselves hyphenated.
You're absolutely
so
right.
What has to happen, I think, in learning languages and learning more about other people's cultures.
Exactly.
I think that there can begin a process that would eliminate these kinds of hierarchies. But I think it's also a problem of power. And unfortunately, if we look at the dynamic today of 1% of the population with a lot of wealth and a lot of other people not really feeling the stimulation of the economy because of the way things are structured, or the threat that we have in politics by allowing heavy contributions from certain hegemonic or powerful groups that influence political outcomes. I think it's knowing another language can help in the socialization process, like knowing Spanish can help, but I think that the activism of different groups will probably bring about more action than only cultural awareness. It has to be a program that's going to focus on bringing about equality.
Absolutely. And what we're going to do is wrap up now, and we're going to bring you back on another conversation about how will the political strategies be presented now when we have this other multilingual or other culture within our democracy. That, I'm sure, is another program. Edith, I want to say thank you, and also to mention to the audience that they can get your book on Amazon.com. The name of the book is Forgotten Texts, 19th Century Afro-Argentine Poetic Constructions of Self and Community, which is a collection of poetry. Again, ladies and gentlemen, our very honored guest today has been Dr. Edith Moss Jackson. Thanks again for listening. Thank you, Edith. We're going to take
Thank
a break
you.
And we'll be right back. This is Andell Banks of Wish Upon a Star wrapping up the program today. And our conversation centered around exploring the socialization of multilingual communities in America. We hope we have, and we try to attempt to outline how globalization has thrust communities into greater contact with each other and compelled us to understand multilingual communication. Developments such as diaspora communities, transnational relations, migration, and digital communication have created more multilingual interactions. As we see the way people negotiate language, relationships, and develop proficiencies in diverse languages, we begin to realize that the traditional models of language acquisition and competence lack the capacity to explain contemporary experiences. The search continues to develop more models that explain not only the ways in which non-Western multilingual communities acquire language competence, but how all of us are compelled to learn and use languages in these modern times. We hope we have given you a start in understanding the realizations about multilingual communication and the new questions that need to be offered for further exploration that offer useful insights. This is Andel and Denise Banks, our coordinator, saying, keep reaching for the stars.